walking was a big development for human beings as a species, and learning to walk is a big milestone for the development of individual humans. But as important as walking can be, our next guest says we've designed a world where it can be harder and harder to go for a nice walk, especially if we want some nature along the way. Antonia Malchik is a freelance writer who writes about science, travel, and place. She's the author of A Walking Life. She's worked and walked in Austria, Australia, and Russia. Currently lives and writes from Montana. Antonia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Talk about what got you into this, because walking is something I think is really easy for us humans to take for granted.
It really is. One of the reasons I actually got interested in the subject was because I was living in an area of upstate New York when I first started researching, where it was very hard to walk anywhere. And in fact, once I had kids, I couldn't walk anywhere because the roads weren't safe. They were very narrow. They're sort of these kinds of rural roads that don't have any shoulders and no striping, so no real lanes. And they're supposed to be about 25 miles an hour, but when people start using them for commuting, they go a lot faster and it's quite risky. And I just took a different look at the world around me once I had kids. I thought, my gosh, I can't take them anywhere unless I buckle them into a car seat. And that's really strange when you think about the entirety of human evolution and human history, that we have this whole world now where you can live in a place and not realize that you don't have access to walking anywhere, that you are actually forced to get places by car. And that's kind of started me down the road of researching the subject, and it just ballooned out of there. It's a huge topic.
Yeah, it's amazing from a biomechanical perspective, too, all the stuff that goes into taking one or two steps.
It's incredible. Some of the earliest research I did led me to engineering departments that try to build walking robots. And you might have seen videos, mm-hmm. people might have seen videos from Boston Dynamics, for example, where they have robot dogs that are really quite versatile and they can self-correct their steps. And they make these robots that can open doors. But the amount of work that goes into that is just incredible. And what I found out was that every time we take a step as human beings with our 2 feet that balance on the ground on like 2 little points every time we lift up 1 foot, is that we make about 1 billion calculations per step. And no walking robot actually gets close to that.
Wow.
Yet. They're getting closer, but it's just, you know, the world is a varied place. And especially once you're out of a lab, there's just so much going on underfoot and in the air and in your visual field. And your brain accounts for all of it. And we don't even think about that.
You cover a lot of ground in your book, and you've covered a lot of ground walking in preparation for this book. One thing we wanted to focus on some today was walking, not just anywhere, but in nature or with some kind of nature-like substance around us. Talk about the benefits that can have for our, not just physical, but our mental health too.
It's actually it's a field that's growing, I think, and I can't, you know, verify that particular thing with statistics, but I keep running into more and more studies that cover the beneficial effects of walking in nature or walking in green spaces, say if you live in a city that has really good parks. Like Denver, for example, is a city with really beautiful, incredible parks and green spaces that you can walk in. And its effects on your mental health. So depression, anxiety, some more serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia have been shown to decrease even with 20-minute walks in nature, up to an hour is even more. Children with ADHD, if they spend 20 minutes per day in green spaces, just even, you know, running around and doing what kids do, the effects on them can be almost as significant as with medication. There's been a lot of studies on even physical health, the outcomes of physical health in people with lower socioeconomic status. This is specifically out of Britain. For example, even though they have access to all the same medical care because they have a national health plan, it's not as good in general, but that can be balanced out by having access to green spaces. And so it's really incredible. And some of the studies I've run into, like one out of the University of Michigan, is starting to look at how the brain actually responds to nature versus, say, being in a city. And what they're finding is that being in green spaces, especially quieter ones that don't have a lot of traffic noise, bring your attention into a calmer space. So it takes your attention from what they call a bottom-up fashion that's much more relaxed, whereas urban environments tend to demand your attention in ways that are more stressful.
Talking to Anthony Amalchik, author of the book A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Freedom One Step at a Time. You talk about Denver a fair amount in your book as a city that's trying to turn things around when it comes to walking and, to an extent, green space. Do you see this as a trend? More communities saying, hey, we got to make it so we can walk again.
Well, I sometimes wonder if I'm a little biased because I talk to so many people who do work in this field, especially urban planners and walkability activists. But I do feel like it's a trend. And part of the reason is that there's pressure from a lot of different directions. There's the health direction. You know, we all know that we don't move enough in our lives. Sitting is really bad for us. And yet the way that our world is structured doesn't give us a lot of opportunity to change that. So instead of walking to work or walking to school, we're always in the car. And so a lot of people just feel trapped by that. And younger generations in particular don't want that kind of life anymore. They want a lifestyle where they can just be active in their daily lives without having to get a gym membership, show up there for an hour, and then sit at your desk for 7 or 8 hours a day. So there's that pressure. You know, every city, every rural area is growing. I live in a town of about 7,000 people, and my entire county is growing really fast. And the more people who live in a place, the more you have to accommodate them getting around. And, you know, we've all seen pictures of like Los Angeles traffic, or maybe we sit in Los Angeles traffic or New York City traffic. I've certainly sat in traffic in New York City. Or you just sit there thinking, why would we do this to ourselves? You know, I have lived in Europe off and on over the years, and it is very different to know that you don't have to have a car to get places. So there's a lot of pressure from younger generations to provide more options for mobility, walking and public transportation as a combination. And I think people just, they want a different kind of life in a lot of ways. They want more connected communities, especially over the last few years. That theme comes up more and more frequently. A lot of people are tired of, you know, living in suburbs that are disconnected from a wider community, you know, living in a place where you can't walk to a coffee shop, you can't walk to a post office, you don't really see your neighbors. And people are realizing that something they're craving is not necessarily, you know, the right size house with a two-car garage, but connection with other people in ways that feel healthy and mobile.
And you write Antonia, that it's not just a matter of we've chosen to stop walking and to start driving. You write that we've designed our communities in ways that make it prohibitively difficult, as you were saying earlier, to choose to walk.
Yes. One of the sources that I talk to quite a bit is a man named Peter Norton, who's a, what does he study? The history of technology. And he wrote this amazing book called Fighting Traffic that really delves into the early 1900s and how we lost walking through car-centric design. And it wasn't something that people chose. It was very much pushed on the American population and really on the North American population, because Canada has very similar infrastructure in a lot of ways, by the car industry and the oil industry. And I'm sure that those industries didn't intend to make a world that wasn't walkable. But what they thought they were doing was, well, first of all, they were selling cars, which is, you know, really important. But they were selling this idea of freedom. You know, you get in your car and you can just drive where you need to go. And the idea is never part of that. Pedestrian deaths, traffic crashes, that's never part of that image. And there was a huge fight at the beginning of the 1900s, around the 1920s, to get cars out of cities, actually, or at least to reduce their speeds to about 5 miles per hour. And that's because there were just so many deaths, especially of children, because everybody had the right to the roads at that time. If you look videos from that time period, there were no traffic lights, there's no stop signs, there's no crosswalks. Everybody's just all over the place, and that's how it was. And partly as a result, a lot of people died once cars really started to come on the road and a lot of drivers were irresponsible. Well, the answer to that, instead of kind of limiting car use within cities, was to shunt pedestrians and other traffic, quote unquote, say bicycles, to the sidewalks. And so we lost access to the road as a public space. And then over time, you know, the highway bill came through and a lot of suburbs were built to serve highways, and then highways were built to serve suburbs, and it kind of turned into this self-feeding highway building frenzy. And what you find is in a lot of the like mid-century suburbs, you will still have some sidewalks, but they're pretty limited. And then as time goes on, there's just no sidewalks at all. You just have the road to your cul-de-sac to your garage. And you realize that people don't make that choice. It's made for them by the people who are designing the space, and then through things like zoning laws and engineering requirements. I was listening to the previous guest, Lord Brown, and he was talking about engineering needing to serve the needs of human beings. And I think this is a case where engineering did not do that. It served the needs of one industry and this kind of fantasy of what car ownership would be, that it would be freedom, when it turned out to take away freedom.
We're talking about the benefits and joys of walking, walking in nature, walking in communities, and the obstacles to doing it. Antonia Malchik is with us, author of the book, A Walking Life. We asked Antonia around here at Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television. Susan writes, she just moved here from Florida. She loves the Madison Parks and Madison Fun Walks every weekend. They even went this past February to a walk in sleet, rain, and snow. Six of us started. She says only four made it through to the end. You are a fan, I think, Antonia, of walking rain or shine, right?
I am a very big fan. And something that happened when I first started working on this was I would, you know, my friends would want to meet for coffee and I'd say, hey, let's go for a walk. And what I would find is that if it were windy, if it were a little too hot, a little too cold, raining, any of those conditions, my friends would be like, I only really want to go for a walk if the weather's nice out. I thought, man, that's, you know, 100 years and we've just discarded a whole lot of evolution. I love hearing that from your caller, because I just went on a huge hike in Glacier National Park. Well, not huge compared to some people, but it was a big long day hike. It was about 19 miles. And it was the east side of Glacier National Park. And we had weather, a lot of rain where I lived that morning. And over when you get to East Glacier, the weather changes quite a bit. And it had snowed quite a bit up high. And we were hiking up there and we got hailed on and we were tramping through snow and we saw wolverine tracks, and it was actually, objectively speaking, it was kind of miserable, but it felt so invigorating to just be in the world. And that's something that I keep coming back to over and over in my own experience and in different kinds of research, like neuroscience. Just how our brains develop has a lot to do with how we interact with the world. And so I find it really fascinating to just be in the world, no matter what's going on. The one caveat we have where I live is we do get wildfire smoke. And this has been not a bad year for that, but it's getting worse over the years. And so that does kind of keep us indoors. But otherwise, I just find, you know, we can trudge through in any weather. My kids aren't super happy about that, but they've gotten used to it. We buy a lot of rain gear and they put up with it. And recently, I don't know, I was sick recently and I was like, oh, let's just drive down to the farmer's market. And they just looked at me and they were like, we've got raincoats. We'll be fine. Just deal with it, Mom. So maybe a victim of my own advice.
Well, it worked. Sure. Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Steele is with us in Appleton. Steele, hi.
Hey, everybody. My comment, and I was just looking online. People are looking at screens, and then they say you need to take a break, and they say 20 feet. But sometimes, let's say the guy's living in New York City, and then that special day when the sun comes up down the road, but you need to walk a little, and you need to see the horizon. You need to see more than 20 feet. You need to see a few miles to and even if it's a short walk and you can't drive somewhere to, you know, walk around the snow.
Steele, thanks a lot for that call. So a lot there, actually, Antonia, getting away from the screen for a walk, but also changing your view from that screen 2 feet away to 20 feet or even the horizon.
Yeah, which hits on a couple of different things. You know, one of them is that there are increasing cases of myopia in our culture because we do spend so much time on our screens, and children especially, you know, since they're still developing, they suffer from that a lot. And from being indoors too much, there's a lot of illnesses that are starting to resurface that are caused because of vitamin D deficiency, basically, and because kids do spend so much time indoors and on screens, they've really become subject to that. But there's also the psychological aspect, which I think your caller hit on a little bit, which is there's a sense of ease when you're able to look out over a distance. My husband's from England, and he grew up in Nottingham, which is a big industrial city, and his parents never owned a car, and they would love it when we'd come to visit because I was the only driver in the family, and so we'd rent a car and go up to Scotland. And they just loved being able to look out over the horizon. As he said, it just makes a huge difference, I think, in anxiety levels, in depression. There's a lot more research about these things. Just being able to readjust your sense of perspective and your sense of place in the world, I think it affects us on a lot of different levels of being human in ways that we're not even conscious of.
Thanks for that call, Steele. We're talking to Antonia Melchick, author of the book A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom, One Step at a Time. Back to your calls. Paul is with us in Chicago. Paul, hello.
Hello. Sorry, I'm in a car.
That's okay. What do you want to tell us about, Paul?
Well, I grew up in a very small town. I was a distance runner for a long time, so, you know, you'd run out on roads and stuff. I remember when the mayor of the town asked me what kind of improvement they should do, and I said, don't pave the roads, keep them gravel. He didn't want to hear that. But the point I wanted to make was that a lot of people talk about this as though it's sort of communing with nature, that you have to be in a pristine wilderness to enjoy it. And I think some of the people that I've known that have been the biggest walkers are people who live in places like Manhattan or Chicago, where, you know, you're taking the subway, but you're always walking 4 or 5 blocks going anywhere several times a day. And some people will just, you know, it's a mile, but I'm just going to walk it, you know. So I want to comment on that.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And I'm guessing, Antonia, no argument from you about the benefits of urban walking.
Absolutely not. I did focus a lot on urban settings in my book, and partly because most people live in cities. And I am fortunate enough to live next to millions of acres of wilderness and Glacier National Park. But almost nobody in the world has that kind of access. And I think it's really important that you're able to feel fully alive and fully human wherever it is that you live. There's actually, I think you said the caller was from Chicago. There's an organization called the Center for Humans and Nature that's based in Chicago. And one of the things they are constantly doing is trying to get people to focus on the small little pockets of nature that are within cities as well. And I think that's just part of walking in general, like living at a walking pace, that you pay attention to what's around you, whatever it happens to be. I lived in Boston for a couple of years, and one of the abiding memories I have is all the window boxes that people put out in the spring. It's a really big thing there, and you just walk around and you look at all these tiny little petunias and marigolds and things that people are growing on their, you know, brick buildings. And it's beautiful. And you can connect with nature in a city. You can connect with people in a city. And you definitely can connect with yourself in a city. I actually really love city walking.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Antonia, before we run out of time, you don't just write about walking exactly in your book. You also look at people who might be in wheelchairs, have paraplegia, people who do walk with some kind of prosthesis. Talk about how that fit into your picture of walking.
Well, it actually came about because one of the things is I've read just tons and tons of books about walking and around walking, and only one of them had even briefly mentioned disability. And I thought that was really strange because one of the things I get to into the book is evolution and evolutionary biology and this idea that bipedality, you know, this walking on 2 feet is what makes us human because it's unique to the human species. And I thought, well, if you're going to say that walking makes us human, then you really need to address that in the context of disability. What if you are not bipedal? And part of the reason that's important to me is because there's 2 people in my family who get around with wheelchairs. And I say at the beginning of the book that really walking, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, it is bipedality. But from a perspective of being human, for me, it's just being as fully present in the world as is possible for every human being. And I think as far as infrastructure goes, it is really essential that we provide that for everybody. And universal design is that's part of it. You have to, if your only way of getting around outside is with a wheelchair, then there's no reason that we can't build infrastructure that accommodates that. And that kind of design actually does benefit everybody, say small children, elderly people who might be a little less stable. And I think it's a really important aspect of walking, and also about the future of walking. When you're looking at prosthetics and robotics, those things are going through huge advances. And it's really, I think, going to change the way we think about being human. And it's a fascinating area of research and future work as far as technology goes.
Antonia, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That's Antonia Malchuk. We've been talking about her book, A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom, One Step at a Time.